Among the mourners for Hubert Humphrey was the man who defeated him for the presidency in 1968, Richard Nixon. The former president came to Washington for the memorial service but made no public remarks. That would come later in the year in Hyden, Kentucky, where the top official of Leslie County, Judge Executive C. Allen Muncy, welcomed him.
When we asked the question, who helped us the most, that was just one answer, Nixon. It's not just revenue sharing that he did. We liked his policy, his war policy in Vietnam. He carried the war to the enemy. He forced them to come to the peace table. He brought the prisoners of war home. He stopped the killing. He led the country through probably the most, probably the worst domestic crisis since the Depression or maybe the Civil War. And, you know, this Watergate business didn't enter our minds.
You all know that song, My Old Kentucky Home. And whenever I come to Kentucky, whether it's to London or to Hyden or maybe to Lexington or to Louisville or wherever the case might be, but when I'm in Kentucky, I always feel I'm at home.
It is my honor and my great privilege to introduce to you the former President of the United States, the Honorable Richard M. Nixon.
There are those who say that war between the Soviet Union and the United States is inevitable. I disagree. Death is always inevitable, but suicide is not. And that is why I say that this is a time when we could well, in the field of negotiations, cool the public rhetoric and toughen up the private bargaining. At a time, for example, when dictatorships are stepping up their covert and subversive activities all over the world, the United States should strengthen rather than weaken the capability of our CIA to counter their activities throughout the world.
There were new names in the news in 1978. Diana Nyad, Stella Taylor, and Walter Ponish took off for open water ocean swims of 100 miles or more. Marathon swims, they're called. The two women failed. Ponish claims he made it to Florida. Nyad's swim had the best publicity, and often she was asked why she did it.
I've worked 20 years now at a sport which is not very sociable and which does not command a great deal of recognition. And I feel that I've gotten to be the best at it, and no one knows it. I'm ready to quit marathon swimming. You know, the love affair is over. And I thought that before I go out, I would like that Olympic moment, just like most other athletes get, whether they're pro or amateur. I want to do a swim that everybody knows about, and everybody says, my God, this is a sport that requires more courage and more guts than anything I've ever seen. But that's why I'm doing this swim.
We saw them on radar, and we advised them that they had crossed the coast, and that they were overjoyed at that point, and there were quite a few shouts of jubilation. They couldn't believe their luck, and they said to pass on to the people back home that they had brought the big one home, is what they said.
The balloon that carried the three Americans across the transatlantic has landed in a grain field near a little village just north of Paris. The scene here is absolutely tumultuous. Motorists are stopping, thousands of cars are jamming up in a massive traffic snarl, and people are running through the fields to give the three Americans a riotous welcome.
After we made Ireland, we went on and overflew England, and after we overflew England, we went for France. When we made France, we decided to go for Paris. And after Paris, we're going to Italy.
The three men look unshaven, sunburned but fit, ready to carry on to Paris by helicopter.
We actually had to fight our way out of the crowd and fight our way into the helicopter. And the only way the helicopters took off was to start their engine.
They say they're going back on the Concorde. They say they came the slowest way. They want to go out the fastest. Marcus Eliasson, Miseré, France.
In sports, as in many of the games themselves, turnover became important as members of the old guard faded and the new guard shined. Names like Joe Namath and John Havlicek dropped from the sports scene through retirement, Namath ending his long and glorified quarterbacking career for a short and unsuccessful bid as a TV star. For Havlicek, the Boston Celtics have been his home for many years, but he left them without regret.
The career that I've had has been one that's a great deal of success and happiness, and I'm not going out with the thought of something sad or anything like that, because everything that a player could possibly accomplish has been something that I have done.
The same could be said about and by Pete Rose, the Reds' third baseman, who picked up hit number 3,000, a rare milestone, and then established a new National League mark for consecutive hitting games. Joe Nuxall called the play-by-play for Cincinnati radio station WLW.
They say there it is! That's number 38 as Pete lines it to left field. Now, Pete Rose has just set a new National League mark as Willie Montanez shakes his hand.
But Rose never did shake hands with the Reds management on a new contract, so he went searching for other work as a free agent. Early in the tennis season, Martina Navratilova won 6 tournaments in a row, her incredible streak made somewhat less meaningful because it occurred while top-ranked female Chris Evert took a vacation. At Wimbledon, though, Martina beat Chris in a head-to-head match for the title. Golfing rookie Nancy Lopez took on the LPGA's biggest guns to put together a 5-tourney win streak. Yet just when it looked as if she might never be beaten, she was, by 15 strokes at the Lady Keystone tourney. Lopez took defeat in stride.
I wanted to win this week, of course, but I'm not disappointed. I just think, you know, thank God I did this well so far, and I've got many years to go, and I've got the rest of this year to go. So I'm just looking forward to the rest of the tournament.
Lopez regained her touch in time to win the European Open. Among the men, Gary Player won the Masters. The New York Yankees, dubbed the Bronx Zoo by reliever Sparky Lyle, got off on the wrong foot in attempting to defend their World Series crown. Turmoil in the locker room seemed to sap their strength on the field. Tension mounted, bringing about a whirlwind of statements and actions by Yanks president Al Rosen, manager Billy Martin, and owner George Steinbrenner.
We just went right out and did what we had to do and gave Billy a real vote of confidence and told him to go out and catch the Red Sox.
Reggie Jackson is suspended without pay effectively for disregard of manager's instructions during his at-bat in the 10th inning.
I expected them to accept whatever role they're given from this point on, without gripe, and do the best they can because they are among the best paid athletes in the world.
The team has a shot at the pennant, and I hope they win it. I owe it to my health and my mental well-being to resign.
Martin was replaced by Bob Lemon, and the Yanks squeezed past Boston for the American League East title. They beat Kansas City in the playoffs and won the World Series again over the Dodgers. Indians, angry over what they considered anti-Indian legislation in Congress, made what they called the longest walk, cross-country, dramatizing along the way and verbalizing when they reached the Capitol.
Over 100 nations are present. Representatives of hundreds of Indian organizations and concerns have been unified here in this longest walk.
This country has had its attention focused on the issues of human rights, as they are being denied to a person in the Soviet Union. And I say it's about time we focus on the human rights of people here in this country.
We have reached enough congressmen, enough senators, and even more importantly, enough individuals who are just plain citizens on this longest walk.
I thank you for not only dramatizing the history of oppression and genocide, broken promises and broken treaties of the red people, but also dramatizing the oppressive conditions under which blacks, browns, red, yellow, and millions of whites live in this country.
The people were swindled, were murdered, were treated like animals.
People in their local towns at first were skeptical, you know, they didn't know what we were. They've been so miseducated in America, you know, there were all kinds of negative worries. And yet, by the time they had listened to us and talked with us and prayed with us, they realized that we were on a legitimate mission.
They're trying to make us to live like their way, your way, you know, white people's way.
We just want to be in there.
Coal miners are frequently thought of as being the sort of hard-working folks who make America what it is. But in coal country, it is said that before a child learns to say mama and papa, he learns to say, no contract, no work. The United Mine Workers contract with the coal operators in many states expired in 1978, and without a contract, there was no work. There was bargaining, and the issue was not money so much as the economics of medical care.
Coal miners, ever since I've been young, my dad was a UMWA member, never had to pay anything for going to the hospital or anything like that.
We have had it, and we intend to keep it. Coal's important. Mining is hard work.
It's hard on your health?
I think we should have full benefits. And any man that goes in underground, leaving his family, he don't know where he's coming back or not. And I think we're treated like a bunch of dogs. Right now's the time to straighten it up.
The strike began in December 1977. About half the nation's coal production was shut down, but huge stockpiles minimized the effects of the strike until those stockpiles dwindled.
The scarcity of electricity will bring about 500,000 to 750,000 unemployed people, and this is just the start.
Supplies at many coal-fired generating plants, which are dependent upon coal from mines affected by the strike, have declined to critical levels.
They've not got a contract. They just got a piece of paper with a lot of ifs and ands and buts not in it.
No, they're not going to have that much effect because they don't have many votes.
I'm disappointed that this agreement was not approved. But this rejection by the United Mine Workers, collective bargaining is now at an impasse. We are still producing about 50% as much coal, and the reserve supplies of coal are down below December the 5th, only about 45%. So I believe that if we can get a moderate number, hopefully all, but a moderate number of coal miners to go back to work, that we can prevent a crisis.
All of our mines were open and ready for the men to go to work at 7 o'clock Friday morning. However, out of the 16,000 or so union employees that we had only two apprentice miners show up for work in southern West Virginia.
If the rest of the miners went back, I would too. But they don't, I'm not. The union is by majority, and that's the way we stick together, by majority.
He's been to the well two times now and come back with dry buckets both times, so I'm sure, pretty sure, he knows what we want at this time, and it better be in the contract.
Ladies and gentlemen, after a long, arduous day, rather hectic, we are prepared to say now that with the potential possible votes that are outstanding, if they all voted no, this contract would be accepted.
Despite the increase in the cost of food at the supermarket, farmers complained often bitterly and dramatically that the money wasn't coming to them.
Well, the main strike issue is 100% parity, and this is just what we need to come out. I've been farming for about 5 years now, and every year I've got to lay my whole life on the line just to go back into the field and get something in return for the coming year.
It's a simple fact that the middleman and everybody else is scabbing off the farmer.
We're losing young guys every year. Last year, Minnesota lost 1,000 farmers, and if it continues, they say next year will be 2,000 farmers, and it's just a steady decline.
Take a box of cornflakes, for example. They're selling off about 81, 97 cents, whatever, and the farmer gets about 2.2 cents out of that. Back in 64, they got 4.7 cents, and they sold the cornflakes for about 50-some cents. And back in the 40s, they sold it for 40-some cents, and the farmer got 2.4 cents out of that.
We want the consumers and the nation as a whole to realize the problems and the situation that the American farmer is under at this time.
So I got a hold of the Home Administration, talked about land depreciation. I said, weather's bad, the crops won't grow. I said, hey, give me a government loan. They said, no, sir. We can't help you. Yes, sir, you got the wrong number. No, sir, we can't help you. Hang up the phone and try this number. So I grabbed the phone. It was a realtor. I asked that fella if he had heard anything about the farming man getting booted right off his land.
Americans reacted in many ways. For example, this was heard in a New York City supermarket.
I think for one thing, we're great meat eaters. We eat much too much meat, and I think we're going into more of these ordinary prepared dishes, casseroles and things of that nature, to fill it out.
You have to compare the prices.
Meat naturally is the most expensive item, so if I see something that's on sale, I buy it and then keep it.
I don't buy beef, no.
The nation seemed to be looking to government to do something about rising costs.
Economically and in spirit, the state of our union is sound. I do not believe in wage and price controls. A sincere commitment to voluntary constraint provides a way, perhaps the only way, to fight inflation without government interference. I see no reason for a telephone operator or a supervisor or a person who works with their hands to pay for a three-martini lunch for some big-shot business executive, $50 a day. This has been part of our tax law too long, and I see no reason either for the tax privileges that have in the past encouraged American businesses to transfer American jobs overseas when we still need the jobs here in our own country. So I need your help with that.
We will set specific standards for both wages and prices throughout the economy. We will use all the powers at our disposal to make this program work. And these proposals, which give us a chance, also deserve a chance. If tomorrow or next week or next month you ridicule them, ignore them, pick them apart before they have a chance to work, then you will have reduced their chance of succeeding.
Cotter picked Cornell economist Alfred Kahn to be an inflation watchdog.
If I've proved anything by my professional career, I have proved that I will not be a party to a graceful transition to mandatory controls. It is simply not true that that is what I contemplate.
If the inflation accelerates, is permitted to accelerate, sooner or later, we will have such a tightening, such a total breakdown of the organization and morale of our economy that we'll have a deep, deep depression.
During the year, the president pointed to two groups whose prices he thought definitely needed some voluntary control.
I know that doctors care very seriously about their patients. But when you get doctors organized into the American Medical Association, and their interest is to protect the interest not of patients, but of doctors.
90% of our lawyers serve 10% of our people. We are over-lawyered and underrepresented.
With pocketbook issues so much in the news, a man named Howard Jarvis became a well-known American, not by going to the moon or running for vice president, but by writing something called Proposition 13. A California tax-slashing ballot question that spearheaded what became known as the taxpayers' revolt.
I think we have to put a limit on spending in the federal level in some manner. It's very difficult, I think.
In February, at the National Governors Conference, California Governor Jerry Brown spotted the taxpayers' revolt as the hot issue it was to become.
The taxpayers' revolt that is growing at the local level will certainly not be satisfied by a tax cut that comes at the federal level, but is paid for out of programs that are being financed by the local taxpayer, but initiated, encouraged, and in some cases almost forced at the federal level.
Proposition 13 passed, but its effect on budgets was largely blunted by a huge state surplus, which tided the state over. Taxes did go down, though. Republicans seized on the issue, trying to pass something called Roth-Kemp in Congress to mandate federal tax cuts. Senator William Roth of Delaware explained the proposal when a barnstorming political caravan called the GOP Tax Blitz reached Upper Darby, Pennsylvania.
We have to change this country to a new direction. We've seen government grow and grow year by year. We've seen spending go up and up. No problem solved. And the American people are tired of it.
Although tax issues were important, there was little evidence that they had an impact nationally at the polls. Many had expected the Panama Canal issue to hang over the 1978 elections, and Ronald Reagan campaigned against the treaties.
Isn't it time for us to take a collective deep breath to realize that our negotiators took a wrong turn some months ago, but that the mistakes can be corrected? We don't have to plunge into a series of fresh mistakes to replace a workable, sensible, and time-tested system with a bundle of uncertainties. Greatness may be measured in many ways. Carrying out our responsibilities as a nation is one of them.
Ratification came after long debate. The treaties guaranteed the canal's neutrality after the year 2000 and governed the operation and defense of the canal until the last day of 1999, when the U.S. would turn it over to Panama.
Talmadge, Weicker, and Williams.
On this vote, the yeas are 68, the nays are 32. Two-thirds of the senators present having voted in the affirmative, the resolution of ratification as amended is agreed to.
The next day was a holiday in Panama, and there were celebrations and protests. Students had been protesting for a week, claiming that Torrijos was making the treaties without the support of his people. They demanded he put the treaties and the amendments he and the U.S. Senate had agreed to a nationwide vote. That never happened. And on June 17th in Panama City, Panama,
under the treaties, our two governments agree to maintain the neutrality and security of the canal. At the same time, we reaffirmed our commitment to honor national sovereignty and the principle of non-intervention.
Este es un momento de gran importancia histórica. Las naciones de nuestro hemisferio están inaugurando una nueva relación de mayor igualdad.
After the difficult debates in our country, it's also a great pleasure to be among so many people who are in favor of the ratification of the treaties. I wish we had Mr. George Gallup here tonight to take a poll among this group. I believe that the agreement which has now been reached between Panama and the United States of America has established a degree of momentum that will lead to even greater cooperation and friendship in the years to come.
The worst air disaster to date in the United States occurred in San Diego on September 25th.
Having 12 o'clock, 1 mile assessment.
The PSA 707 was making the bank to line up for Lindbergh Airport, and he clipped a small airplane with his right wing.
We're going down. This is PSA. Okay, we'll call equipment for you.
They both blew up right away. The PSA was, it was a huge explosion, and they both caught fire, and the PSA kept the bank that he was into, only he just nosed down about 80 degree angles.
It was just going straight down, and it was going fast. It hit, exploded, and black smoke immediately.
Just a big mushroom. It was enormous, and the fire went out fairly quick, but the smoke, the natural, just kept billowing.
The Cessna fell to the ground about, oh, 3 or 4 blocks away.
Cessna 1483, 727 went in, and you can see the smoke north of you.
It's almost beyond description. There are not very many whole bodies around. There are fragments. It is an area that's covered with bits of cloth, each cloth denoting part of a body.
A lot of people spread all over the place. I've never seen nothing like it. I don't want to see any more. I'm off duty. I'm going home.
Boston 476 is with you downwind. Boy, what blew up out there? 727 went in.
Oh, God. Who's?
150 people were killed as the small plane and a Pacific Southwest Airlines jet collided. The crash was photographed by a still photographer who captured the image of the jet falling and a TV station photographer who caught the plummet of the small plane. The pilot of the small plane was practicing instrument approaches, and the jetliner was making a bank for a landing at San Diego's close-in Lindbergh Field. But the Pacific Southwest crash was not the world's worst disaster in 1978. The year started off with the crash of an Air India jet on New Year's Day. 213 died when the 747 jet crashed near Bombay. A National Airlines jet also crashed, landing in Escambia Bay in Florida, and 3 were killed. Carl Willenda, leader of a family of high-wire daredevils, got caught in a draft while walking a wire in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
I was almost underneath, but away for about 15 feet. The wind was very, very strong, very powerful. And he couldn't balance himself properly. Until then, he had been halfway across between the two buildings. But at the other point where he was going, was the wind seemed to be stronger. And he was trying to balance himself with a bar he uses. And finally, he just couldn't hold on too well. And the bar, either he threw it off or he fell off. Started to fall down. He grabbed onto the cable with one hand for a few seconds only. And he plunged to the sidewalk.
He had feared winds more than anything else.
There comes times that you can't even walk under wire. You have to. I had a lot of times I had so much wind that I had to sit down under wire and had to make a pause, you know, take it easy, you know. And after a little while, when the wind lays down a little bit, then I could go ahead again.
The Willenda Family Show went on. Ventriloquist Edgar Bergen died. He had announced his retirement just days before his death.
I feel that it's time to do it. I celebrated my 75th, and I get tired of working and saving money and then sharing it with those that didn't.
Charlie McCarthy, the dummy that Bergen worked with, was willed to the Smithsonian, but got in a final shot at his boss at the retirement news conference.
It's
not been easy. The man has no talent.
The scare of the year came in January when a Soviet satellite powered by a nuclear device crashed to the earth in a remote corner of Canada.
It had this long trail of, like a flame behind it, eh?
We're grateful that it did not fall within a populated area. Quite obviously, if it had fallen in a metropolitan area, it would have been a catastrophe of some kind.
Can you describe it as a crater that we came across, maybe 10 to 12 inches deep in the snow, melted down to an ice, and out of the ice was sticking several struts. The kind of wind and the kind of cold that we were going against kind of fatigued the mind. And on the way back, after we had called the object, we did jokingly suggest to each other that it was indeed a satellite and it was Russian. We both had a big giggle and kept going.
Those who found the satellite debris suffered no apparent after effects. A Korean rice dealer was in the headlines much of 1978. Tung Soon Park testified before Congress about his dealings with members of Congress, allegedly in an effort to buy influence.
My respect for my friends in Congress was such that I never made any attempt to twist their arms or tell them how to vote. I took them as someone who are not only hardworking people, but with a great deal of intelligence of their own. They could make their own judgment, but all I wanted to do, because they are busy, they cannot make the business of knowing certain things about Korea, I brought certain information and make them aware.
After 18 months of testimony and investigating, the House reprimanded three congressmen for official misconduct in the Korean lobbying scandal. For the first time ever, the House of Representatives allowed live broadcast of regular House sessions in 1978. Congressman Charles Rose helped set it up.
Last year, the House passed a resolution which set forth a procedure whereby the Speaker would go through the process of broadcasting the House proceedings. But most importantly, the Associated Press Radio Network asked the Speaker specifically for permission to broadcast the proceedings of the House.
The House will be in order. The Chair lays before the House the following communication.
That's America's newest radio show, The House of Representatives in Action. Acting Speaker Jim Wright banged down the gavel at noontime that brought the House into a new era, regular radio news coverage of its proceedings. Charles Van Dyke, Capitol Hill.
Congressman Albert Gore was the first to be broadcast.
Most Americans get most of their news today from the broadcast media. The American people want to know more about the important issues affecting our country. They want to know more about the actions of their elected representatives in Washington. I believe we are serving their interests well by permitting broadcast coverage of our floor debates.
One of the biggest gatherings in Washington in years was in support of the Equal Rights Amendment. Betty Friedan, founder of the National Organization for Women, told the gathering in June of the pressure on Congress to extend the deadline for ratification of the ERA.
We say to these members of Congress, watch, watch it. We are serious, we are determined, we will not forgive, we will not forget.
A month later, the House approved the extension. And in August, the 1980 presidential race began.
It is my hope that I can do it without federal financing. That may be an unrealistic hope, but I frankly am opposed to the idea that a McGovern supporter with his tax dollars should have to support a Phil Crane on the hustings, as much as I'm opposed to a Phil Crane's tax dollars being used to promote the candidacy of a George McGovern.
Congressman Philip Crane, Republican of Illinois, the first declared presidential candidate.